Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch you up on the political news in Ohio and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Today, I'm joined at the roundtable by Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Good morning.
Great to be here, Anna.
Haley B. Miller, political reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. Hi.
Happy almost Thanksgiving.
I know. And Julie Carr-Smythe rounds out our all-female roundtable. She's a government and politics reporter for the Associated Press. Good morning.
Happy to be here.
So, let's start with the obvious elephant in the room. Ohio Senate President Matt Huffman is set to become the next Speaker of the House. It's a power move that hasn't been done for more than 100 years. Setting up a government in the new year that could move all kinds of Republican plans to transform higher education, eliminate income taxes, and basically push the state further to the right. Joe, we all expected the vote for House Speaker to be between Huffman and the current Speaker, Jason Stevens. But in the end, Huffman won unopposed. How did we get there? Because it all unfolded last week.
Yeah, it all unfolded a couple of days before. I think it was the day before the vote, actually. The current House Speaker, who's Jason Stevens from Southern Ohio, he held a news conference and he said he had accomplished a lot of his goals and that he had decided that he would not run. So he kind of pulled his name out of the hat.
We have a cut of Stevens from that press conference that we're going to play now.
I will not have my name placed in nomination as a candidate for Speaker during the Wednesday caucus. I am honored and look forward to continuing to serve the great constituents of the beautiful 93rd District of Ohio as state representative. I will keep working hard to stand for a strong economy that cares for both the young and the old, that supports our schools and our children's education, and ensures we have a government that is run responsibly, efficiently, and with accountability.
Julie, when Stevens dropped out, I assumed that was because Huffman had the votes, the majority of the caucus, to become Speaker, and it's always better to leave than lose. But then there's this other representative, freshman Tim Barhorst, who says, I'm actually going to run for Speaker, and I've got the votes.
Right. Barhorst is pretty conservative.
Barhorst, the dark horse. Sorry.
Yeah. And he's a pretty conservative guy. Like you say, he's a freshman. Now, of course, at the State House, you have to move fast. We have term limits, and we've seen this before where people get kind of ambitious. But yeah, it was a real unclear situation of, you know, is he trying to step in here to, move the caucus to the right? Has he been thrown in like, you know, a libertarian in the 9th district who throw things off? And then in the end, he didn't even surface as a candidate.
Yeah, Haley. So Barhorst and his supporters, which included Ohio gun owners, Ohioans for Medical Freedom, a lot of super conservative groups, they were going around saying, oh, we've got the votes, we've got a majority of the Republicans. And this was a secret ballot behind closed door vote. But Barhorst didn't even end up being nominated. Like, Huffman was voted in unopposed.
Right. It sounds like there was some uncertainty about who was supposed to be officially nominating him. And then for some reason, he didn't choose to nominate himself, which he was well within his right to do. So it was an odd end to a 48-hour campaign that I know frustrated a lot of Republicans who had been working for months and months to get Huffman the Speaker's gavel. So, you know, I think in the end it turned out as expected, but it was interesting to see Barhorst's supporters, you know, saying that he's the true conservative and he's the true Trump ally in the Ohio House, when anyone who knows, you know, Senate President Matt Huffman knows he's not a conservative dude. Yeah.
Yeah, I was talking with one Republican lobbyist who called the whole situation a cluster, word I can't say, on the radio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it makes me wonder, though, Anna, if we're going to have a setup like we did last time around, where they voted caucus leader Derek Marin right after the election. And then, you know, in January, they came back. And Jason Stevens had the help of all of the Democrats in the House and his faction of supporters, and he was able to force his way in as Speaker of the House with the help of Democrats. And Huffman right now is kind of, you know, he's told the Democrats, respect where we are, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I don't know what's going on behind the scenes. None of us do. And has there been a deal cut somewhere that you know, they're going to allow the Democrats to have some say in some things? Or will someone come in, maybe Barhorse come in over the vacation, the Christmas vacation, holiday vacation, and cut a deal under the table to get, you know, basically the same thing that happened last time?
Right, because the tension here is that Jason Stevens had to use support from Democrats to become Speaker, and as you mentioned in the at the top, you know, that caused this session to be, number one, very historically slow in terms of legislation, but also he was able to block some things that Democrats didn't want, you know.
I can't see Barhorst working with the Democrats, though.
Same. That's what I'm saying, is that if if you get somebody, it's the tension, I think, between a Barhorst who's going to say, I just want to run it with only Republican support, I don't want to offer anything to Democrats, and Huffman, who though conservative, may be, you know, he's been a lawmaker and a deal maker for a very long time, and he probably realizes that there's some benefit in that.
Yeah, I want to play a cut of currently Senate President Matt Huffman touting his accomplishments.
What I've done in terms of campaign support when I was in the House and in the Senate, and then also what I've done in the past year or so regarding issue one.
Issue one, obviously, being he takes credit for helping take it down. Victory has 1,000 mothers, but defeat is an orphan. But I do think he's going to push through a pretty conservative agenda, especially now that in the Senate president-elect is Rob McCauley, a Republican that has a good friendly relationship with Matt Huffman. They won't be butting heads like we've seen a lot in legislatures past.
Yeah, one of my big predictions for the next General Assembly is that the recreational marijuana law is going to get slashed to pieces.
Yeah.
You know, at the very least, I think they're going to change the tax structure and where the revenue goes. But this is something that Senate Republicans have wanted to get done since issue two passed last year. And House Speaker Jason Stevens was very much an obstacle to that. So I think if you have Huffman and McCauley each leading a chamber, you know, that's
it could
move.
Do you think they'll do you think they will mess with home grow? Because that's one thing that they had talked about restricting.
Probably. And it's going to be, I mean, it's going to be tougher to do now that the law has been in effect for over a year and sales started in August. So it is going to be a tougher sell, I think, to Ohioans. And certainly Democrats aren't going to be on board with wholesale changes to the law, but that may not matter.
The benefit of it. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. One thing, though, that they have to remember when they do that is that out in, you know, the counties, a lot of Republican reg counties, the marijuana law is actually going over spectacularly if you talk to people, because they like the idea of home grow and they like the idea of legal marijuana. And for a lot of people, it gives the opportunity to try that as a method of pain relief in basically medical deserts. We don't have health care in some of these rural counties like we need. People don't go to the doctor as much as they would maybe if they had more availability. And, you know, it's seen differently in those counties. So, I mean, Republicans really have to look at that carefully when they're trying to change it.
Yeah, I was just going to say this probably will mean a return of the big three, which is the governor, the Senate president, and the House Speaker, which kind of went by the wayside with this double caucus in the House. But I've always been fascinated by the fact that, you know, Huffman himself, as he positioned for this, perpetuated that, really, because he initially could have said, I'm not going to work with the second caucus, I'm going to work with the elected Speaker of the House. And he chose to not do that. And he had friends in the second caucus. And so he actually has been positioning for this for at least 2 years. And we've seen the results of that, which have been, as I said, historically low numbers of bills passed.
Before we move on to another topic, I want to take a moment to remember Senator Kirk Schering. The Republican from Stark County died last week after serving 31 years in our state legislature. And I have to say, personally, he was always one of my favorite lawmakers to call. Schering was incredibly smart and one of a handful of people who actually knows how the public pension systems work. I once teased him that he couldn't retire because he was the only one who understood how they worked and how to pass changes. So I think he was really the guy leadership called when they needed to move a complicated piece of legislation. Joe, Julie, you've covered the State House longer than me, so you got to see more of Schering's career.
Yeah, he was always smiling. He was just a very approachable kind of guy. If you saw him in the hallway, you know, he would talk to you. And, you know, so many of the lawmakers these days have this, you know, they shy away from talking to media. You know, they don't like talking to us. They're afraid of, I don't know why they're afraid to talk to
us.
They don't want to, or I don't know. But anyway, Kirk Schering was never like that.
No, you know, he would always take your call.
He would always talk. And he was accountable to the people in his district. And he actually took their thoughts and their wishes to the State House with him. That's probably why he was always elected when he ran for House and Senate. He was one of those musical chair people that went back and forth. But he will be remembered as someone who was really, he could get the job done.
Yes, and I think that the longevity there, I mean, they're losing a huge bunch of institutional knowledge.
Yeah.
And sort of a person from back at the time when policy really led the day between elections. It used to be literally the day after the election, people saw the lay of the land and they started talking about bills and policy. And we've been in such a hyperbolic time that, you know, he reminds me of that gentler, kinder past of, you know, really just caring about doing the right thing for Ohioans.
Haley, Attorney General, that's funny, in my script. That is a weird Freudian slip. Attorney General Dave Yost is eyeing the governor's office, quite literally. A new video shows Yost walking through the State House, stopping outside DeWine's door, and says an announcement is coming in January. So, Haley, do you think this timing was to make it clear that he just does not want to be our next senator?
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. You know, his name keeps getting put out there for Vice President-elect J.D. Vance's Senate seat, even though Yost has told reporters he's not interested. But also, next year is 2025, which means we're going to start seeing campaigning ramp up for 2026, just the way of the world. But yeah, I mean, this video wasn't a surprise in a lot of ways by any means, but I do think, you know, it sort of puts the pin in any conversations about the Senate seat.
He'll face Lieutenant Governor John Husted, who has DeWine's backing. Julie, how do they compare in terms of support? Because I kind of feel like they both have a good shot at getting it.
Yes. I mean, I think that they both have different constituencies. I mean, Husted came into the governor's race way back when, I guess it was already almost 6 years ago. But, you know, he was very strong support. He was a threat, really, to DeWine. And that's why they cut this deal where he became part of his ticket. He's been really building momentum for this moment his whole career. He's been a House Speaker. He's been a state senator. He's been a Secretary of State. And so, you know, he's got all that. But I think Yost also has been active. He's been the president of the Republican Attorneys General Association and has tried to take on a national role, tough on crime and that kind of thing. He files a lot of lawsuits, amicus briefs, and leads the way on things where he's definitely trying to grab the national narrative. And I think when we look back at how the last two senators have won this state, I think with the news deserts and everything else, if you can grab the national narrative, it's helping you in a statewide race in this state.
On the Democratic side, Amy Acton has expressed interest in running for governor in 2026. I've heard House Minority Leader Allison Russo floated. But beyond that, Joe, I mean, we don't hear a lot of different Democratic names.
You know, the Democrats have a lot of problems. But one big problem they have is the farm team. They do not have a farm team where you have the Republican side. They're stepping on top of each other because there's so many people that they could possibly run for the high offices in the state. The Democrats, you know, they really don't have that. And they have been out of power for so long and buried in the minority for so long that there haven't been the opportunities for people to advance like they do in the Republican Party. That's a problem for them. Amy Acton is a name that became very popular during the COVID pandemic because a lot of Ohioans looked to her for advice on how to handle a virus that none of us knew how to handle. And so she became a very trustworthy name then. And then because of politics and things that happened, she was out of that position. And she hasn't done a lot of high profile things since. So the question is she, if she were to go up against someone else for governor, would she have the ability to get the kind of attention and credibility that she would need to become governor?
And I think a lot hinges on the governor's appointment in this Senate seat, because that seat will be up again in 26. Anyone who doesn't, you know, anyone who watches that and thinks, oh, you know, maybe I'll hop in, like an Allison Russo could hop in there if it looks like he made a pick that was vulnerable. We also could see Sherrod Brown or Tim Ryan. I mean, they do have a farm team in the sense that there are a lot of ambitious Democrats in the state, people in the state house who are hoping, you know. I know that I checked out last week and really none of the mayors, which are really the stars of the party, want to leave their post because
that's fair.
We have Democratic cities and, you know, it's much easier to win in those areas than win statewide.
Coming up, from bathrooms to budgets, we're getting the details on lame duck. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Anna Staber. Still with us is Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Haley B. Miller, political reporter at the Columbus Dispatch, and Julie Carr Smythe, government and politics reporter for the Associated Press. So one of the first things that lawmakers did in their lame duck session is send Governor Mike DeWine a bill banning transgender people from using school bathrooms or locker rooms that are not the same gender as what appears on their birth certificate. But Haley, it now looks like DeWine might not sign it, even though he said in the past he would sign it. What's going on there?
So the governor apparently made some comments at an event last week that I don't know if any reporters were at. I was not. Talking about, I believe it was a reference to concerns that he had about the legislation, which supporters of the bill took to mean that he may not sign it. But then his spokesman quickly clarified that the governor's concerns had been addressed and that he was referencing, you know, previous concerns he had about the bill before it was changed. So he did tell reporters back in June or July that he would sign the legislation in its current form, which is the form that it passed in. You know, I do think part of why there's an open question is because last year he vetoed legislation to ban gender-affirming care for minors and ban transgender girls from playing in female sports. So, you know, I think supporters of the bathroom bill are concerned that they could see a repeat of that again, but all signs seem to be pointing to the fact that DeWine will sign it. A decision is expected sometime in the next few days.
Yeah. The deadline is Wednesday, Joe?
I think the deadline is Friday, but he's not going to do it on Friday. So.
Yeah. Well, I think whenever he does it is probably going to be the opportunity for reporters to be home with their families and ignore it or whatever. So,
speaking of things that Governor Mike DeWine signs, he signed an executive order last week to let colleges pay student athletes for their name, image, and likeness. The executive order takes effect immediately. However, institutions of higher learning will not be allowed to use money allocated by the state. It's the dawn of a new era. Colleges can pay their athletes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, it introduces a whole lot of, there's a lot of questions about NIL. And, you know, it's one of those things that when everyone heard about it at the beginning, it's like, oh, yeah, you know, that's a great idea. But then when you put it in practice, you see that there's a lot of things going on that were unintended consequences. And I think we're kind of starting to see that phase. You know, anytime you interject money into anything, it kind of changes it, and that's what this is about, I think.
Right. I mean, to sort of professionalize it, and these are college students, and, you know, there's always sort of been the resentment factor of they're making big bucks for their universities for zero pay, but they are college students. And so, yeah, it will. I agree with you. Just kind of change, you know, gradually just change the whole feel of it.
Yeah, those who have been Buckeye fans for a long time remember Tattoo Gate, and now it seems so benign given the way. But that was sort of a reflection of the fact that they couldn't earn money off their name, image, or likeness. And some of these athletes don't come from affluent families. They could be theoretically struggling to make ends meet. And
even as they're superstars, right?
Yeah,
on the field.
And that opens the temptation to this kind of thing under the table.
But you got to understand that that's a huge team. That football team is a huge team. And there are guys on that team who don't make that kind of money.
Correct.
And, you know, so you got to wonder what the dynamics are behind the scenes, you know, with the athletes. And then what about the other sports where they're not making that kind of money? I mean, there's a whole lot that you have to unpack with NIL, and we're just starting to see it.
One piece of legislation that doesn't look like it's coming up during lame duck is something called Senate Bill 83. This was a controversial bill that would have killed many DEI programs at public colleges and universities. It would change the way teacher tenure works. At one point, it would have stopped professors from going on strike. Senator Jerry Serino, a Republican, says he's disappointed but not deterred.
Just because the speaker grasp the...
This is on...
A needed reform bill in higher education in Ohio does not in any way take away from its value. And so we will be pursuing this in the future. I will be persistent, as I've told you before, in making this happen.
Haley, it sounds like it's going to come back in the next General Assembly, probably.
Yeah, I think that's on the list of things that the Huffman-McCauley reign will prioritize. That's been a big priority of theirs, and, you know, now they won't have to amend it to death. They can, you know, push it through kind of as originally intended.
This was something that Senator Serino has talked about for a while, sort of trying to get Senate Bill 83 across the finish line, saying, you know, I compromised a lot to get this through the House. I'm not going to compromise if it comes back. And with Huffman in charge of the House, I don't think he will have to.
No, and this is part of a broader concern on the right in this country about education and the idea that liberal values are sort of being pervaded, whether overtly or implied. And I know that the universities are very concerned about it because they're committed to diversity on their staffs, and they don't believe that their institutions are lean liberal. I mean, they have faculties that are very diverse, and it depends what course you take and what professor you have. And their institutions of learning. So we're seeing that up and down from really kindergarten now all the way through universities.
You know, I teach on a college campus, and our college, Ohio Wesleyan University, is very diverse. And they, you know, they actually seek out people to make it diverse because they want the students to have a full experience. A lot of students come to school and they have only been in one kind of environment, right? And I think this is the thing that, you know, there's a concept that teachers are teaching some sort of philosophy or some sort of theology or something. But really what a lot of what ends up happening is these students get on college campuses and they meet people who are different, who think differently, who are different religions, come from different backgrounds, and you grow. When you start to meet someone and you start to understand their culture a little bit better, it affects the way you think about things that you do and say and behave. And, you know, so I think a lot of this thought behind the DEI regulations, I think that's actually getting muddied by the fact that students grow when they're on college campuses. And that's a good thing because they're realizing more about the world around them, and they're using their own problem-solving skills to be able to make their choices in how they do things.
And some of this, I think, goes back to campuses trying to create these free speech zones and to kind of tamp down on hate speech on campus, which a lot of people viewed as a matter of opinion, whether it was hate speech or whether it was just a differing viewpoint of the world. And I know that I teach or I speak every year at a great course at Worthington High Schools that is called the Political History of Political Radicalization in this country. And it's fabulous. It's, you know, they hear from an actual person from these different backgrounds. It could be a Black Panther. It could be a member of the underground from Chicago, you know, these kind of things. And they hear from all varieties, and they get a day to study it, a day to talk to the person, and a day to debrief on it. And the idea is to prepare you for college for exactly what Joe is talking about, where, you know, you're going to encounter this and how to be a critical thinker on campus when you encounter new ideas.
Advocates of public and private education are also watching not only what state lawmakers are going to be doing next year, but what a second Trump administration is going to do. He is talking about eliminating the Department of Education. And Julie, you had a story that looks at how advocates for Christian education are trying to find new ways to tap into taxpayer dollars.
Right. And this was something that came out of the Senate under Matt Huffman. They created a In government, there's always acronyms, but OTSCIF, which is a one-time strategic investment in communities fund, and eight of the projects in there were actual construction dollars for Christian schools. So I looked at the grant applications. It was our new school campus, or we're going to retrofit this, or we're going to add a lab or a cafeteria. We're going to add these and that programs. And the idea that a group called Americans United Against or for Separation of Church and State is saying is that vouchers got around legal concerns because that money goes to parents and parents make the decision. But this was one where the money goes directly from the government, who makes a decision and sends it direct to the school. So the Senate's argument is that those are competitive grants, and therefore the competition serves the same role as like that parent making a decision. But it's,
we'll have to see. Sounds like a court might be deciding that.
Right. Right.
Haley, let's talk about the U.S. Senate, your favorite topic du jour, especially now that we're going to have four back-to-back Senate races.
Yeah, as intended. Not really.
Yeah, so Governor Mike DeWine will appoint someone probably in the new year to replace Vice President-elect J.D. Vance. That person will have to run in 2026 and then again in 2028.
Yeah, and because of that, you know, electability is a big deal for Governor DeWine. He's talked about you know, the importance of someone being able to win a primary, especially, which is why I don't actually think it's going to be State Senator Matt Dolan, even though he has expressed interest and his name has been out there because DeWine endorsed him back in this year's March primary. Other names we've heard are Congressman Mike Carey, and he kind of went public about his interest in the seat over the weekend. We've heard former Ohio Republican Party Chair Jane Timken. So lots of possibilities. I think DeWine's phone is still, you know, ringing off the hook. And we don't know for sure what the vice president-elect's timeline is, but Senator-elect Bernie Moreno intimated last week when he was talking to reporters that he believes at least Vance will stay in the Senate until the last minute to get some of these cabinet appointees kind of starting through the process. So Moreno's expectation, at least, was that he would be serving with Vance for a couple weeks.
Well, then we will have to wait and see. It does seem like the governor is keeping this pretty close to the vest.
Another person who's in the running is Frank LaRose, the Secretary of State, who who did run for the seat before.
Yeah. I've also heard Warren Davidson's name as a possibility. But, you know, we have moved ahead when it comes to elections. We have certified Ohio's election results. And that also means, Joe, that Marcy Kaptur has officially won re-election, narrowly defeating Republican Derek Marin.
Yeah. And I think, what was it, like 300? It was a very small amount of notes.
Yeah. Now, the Libertarian candidate got, 15,000-16,000 votes, so potentially played spoiler in this race. But Marcy Kaptur continues her streak as the longest-serving woman in the U.S. House of Representatives.
She does.
And Derek Marin's out of a job.
Yes,
and I mean that race ultimately cost $23 million.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow.
When you look at the Open Secrets numbers of both campaign and outside spending, they really thought they had a chance because they've drawn that district to be slightly against a Democrat, if you want to put it that way. But she's
a tough competitor.
She is, and she's very well known. I think that outcome was kind of what Sherrod Brown was hoping for in the Senate race, was just that I'm going to be so well known that I'm going to eke it out. And Marcy did, and Sherrod didn't.
Another post-election story that's bubbled up comes from Summit County Court of Common Pleas, where a failed Senate candidate, Jonathan Leisler, a Republican, is now potentially, I don't think he's officially been charged, but he has allegedly taken $4 million from his former employers and spent a portion of that, a non-insignificant portion of that, $800K, against the Democrat who ultimately won the Senate seat.
Yeah. Casey Weinstein won he's a representative now. He's going to be going over to the Senate, and he won it pretty handily. But the thing I talked with now Representative Weinstein about it, and he said, you know, at the very last month of that campaign, it seemed like Leisler had all this money coming in for ads. And he said it was just bombarded with all of these, all this media and all this interest in Leisler. And he was wondering where it all came from. Well, then after the election, I discovered, I can't remember exactly when it was filed, but there's a civil case that from the former employers of Leisler that say he took more than $4 million and about more than $800,000 of that went into Leisler's campaign. So as you said, he has not been charged yet, but he has retained an attorney. Neither Leisler or his attorney have talked to me about this. But it does appear that there's more to the story here. So,
yeah. Coming up, we're talking about future voting rights and whether we might see a constitutional amendment. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Still with us is Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Haley B. Miller, political reporter at the Columbus Dispatch, and Julie Carr Smythe, government and politics reporter for the Associated Press. So we may be looking at more and more constitutional amendments. A proposed voting rights amendment can appear on a future ballot as a single issue, not three issues as was originally considered. The board last week voted unanimously to keep it a single issue. So what does that mean, Julie?
Well, I mean, it makes it easier for voters. It makes it easier for the campaign because they don't have to pull apart the issues and run different.
Right.
And we've had so much confusion in the state to begin with this last ballot issue that I think that it'll make it streamlined for people.
Yeah. And so what it would do is allow same day voter registration. Mm-hmm. It would allow many more ballot boxes. Right now, we can only have one at the Board of Elections. So what else does it do?
It relaxes the voter ID law, could allow more voter locations. Did you just say that? You may have just said that.
No, I said drop boxes.
Oh, okay.
And that's like up to the counties. So, you know, a smaller county like Vinton may be fine with one drop box, one early voting location. But Franklin County, I mean, we saw the lines outside the early voting location for this election very long. So the idea is that maybe these larger counties should have more. It would also same-day voter registration and automatic voter registration. So if you go to the BMV to update your driver's license or get a driver's license, you would just be registered to vote.
Now, you know, the one thing, we saw the lines in Franklin County and, you know, other places, and we all assumed that those were Democrats that were standing in line because, you know, it's in a Democratic county and you think, oh, well, you know, it's early voting and that traditionally was the Democrats coming out to vote. That's probably the way lawmakers think about early voting as well. But look at the numbers. I mean, really, a lot of Republicans early voted. It's convenient for everybody. And they don't say you've got to be this party or that party to early vote. And in fact, the Republicans encouraged it this time around. So it kind of makes me wonder if maybe the legislature will look at early voting just a tinge differently because their own, you know, the Republicans are getting out there and voting too.
Right. And it was pushed all the way from the top from Donald Trump on down for Republicans to early vote this time. And that was a flip for him because previously he had said early voting wasn't safe and vote on election day. And so that made a real shift. And you make a great point that, you know, maybe if it's the Republican voter base being impacted more, it wouldn't be. They might try to cut a compromise, which we've seen in the past, where they say, well, you know, if you wait on this, we'll do something in the legislature that accomplishes the same thing.
Another potential constitutional amendment deals with something called the Ohio Fairness Act. Joe, some Republicans actually, and Democrats have been trying to pass this for a decade at least, and it's gotten nowhere. So they're thinking maybe the ballot?
Yeah, but, you know, it's not the same group of Republicans and Democrats that are behind this. We haven't seen the major human rights groups in Ohio flocking to get behind this. Now, the people who are sponsoring it is called Equal Rights Ohio. These are people who have run this campaign in other states, and they're making an Ohio-specific constitutional amendment. And they're not really ramping up, they said, until 2025. And they said they're trying to get, you know, some of these organizations on board who would be likely to support this. But right now, I've talked with some of the people in some of the organizations, and they're still looking at it. I mean, there are some thoughts about whether this might be the right time, because look at the outcome of the November election. you know, Donald Trump won Ohio by 12 points. And what was the issue? One of the big issues that seemed to get a lot of attention, it was an LGBTQ issue, the trans issue. And so I think there's a lot of people sitting there going, you know, yeah, we agree with it. We want it. But is right now the time to do it?
Haley, that's a question for both of these amendments, right? Do you go in 2025, an off year, or do you go in 2026 when we're going to vote for U.S. Senate and the governor's race, arguably a much higher turnout?
Yeah, I think it's a tough call, especially because the, you know, issue one this year, the, you know, that group, I think, was pretty emphatic about being on the ballot at the same time as a high profile election, high turnout election. And we saw how that turned out for them and ended up coming back to haunt them. So, you know, with issue one and issue two last year, that was an odd year election. You know, both abortion and marijuana were pretty high interesting issues to people. So that, you know, generated a little bit more turnout than maybe you normally would have in an odd year election. So, yeah, I don't know what the right answer is. I think there are pros and cons to each for each of these groups. And I think that's what they're going to be weighing. But if they want to get on the November 25 ballot, they only have until July to collect a lot of signatures. So they really don't have a ton of time to kind of hem and haw over this.
But it's not necessarily true now that a huge turnout election is going to benefit Democrats. We saw really depressed Democratic turnout in the cities in the presidential election. And whereas, as Haley's saying, you know, on an off year, you have the ability to kind of run your campaign, make your arguments, clarify misconceptions. I mean, all the way through from issue one that would have raised the threshold for getting on in our Constitution by to 60%. People understood that quite well and they defeated it, and then they turned around and voted yes on another issue one, which they also really understood. This year, I don't know that it was possible to break through. I've talked to friends who said on this year's issue one, which was on redistricting, they even read the news coverage and they didn't know based on their belief whether to vote yes or no.
Yeah, I know the yes on redistricting, the yes on issue one group spent about like 20, 25 million, something like that. Mm-hmm. But I mean, when there was 700 million spent on the U.S. Senate race, like it just got drowned out by the Sherrod Brown, Bernie Moreno race.
Well, and let's not forget that the ballot language was very confusing to a lot of voters because it basically made the case against issue one in the ballot language. And they kind of got confused. I mean, I had people straight up tell me that they meant to vote yes when they went in because they wanted to change redistricting. But then when they got in there and they read the ballot language, they're like, wait, did I want to vote yes or no? And they ended up voting the wrong way because of the ballot language. So, and there's no guarantee that, you know, you don't know what that ballot language is going to say. And right now, the ballot board is controlled 3-2 majority by Republicans. So if that were to happen, if you were to take one of these ballot issues, take it all the way through, get the signatures, get everything you need, which that takes a lot of time and money. You get all that, you take it in, they change the ballot language to something that is misrepresenting or different than the issue itself, and it confuses voters, then, hey, you've just lost all that money and time.
I want to turn a little bit to national politics. So President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet picks have elicited a lot of reactions, and Ohio's Senator-elect Bernie Moreno has announced his support for whoever Trump picks. He also got behind Matt Gaetz before Matt Gaetz withdrew his nomination for attorney general. Moreno said of Gaetz that he is exactly the type of leader to clean up the corruption and return the DOJ to following the rule of law. So, Haley, it sounds like Moreno is going to be down for whoever Trump picks, and Vance may stick around to help him out.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way, which isn't really surprising. You know, Trump endorsed Moreno in the Senate race, and he really ran a campaign in the mold of the president-elect. They're both businessmen, you know.
His campaign buzz had Trump's face on it, too.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, I think you know, it's pretty clear that Moreno's going to be a staunch ally of Trump in the Senate. And so, you know, if he was willing to support Matt Gaetz, I feel like he's probably down for whoever Trump's going to nominate.
Right. And this could be part and parcel of the discussions they had when Trump decided to endorse Moreno.
Yeah, both him and Secretary of State Frank LaRose were hoping to get that endorsement. Ultimately, I mean, it was what made the difference in that primary.
Yes, and I think in J.D. Vance's as well. And so the one case where a Trump-endorsed person did not win is in that Marcy Kaptur district.
Two times in a row. He picked J.R. Majewski the time before. That was his guy.
Yeah, yeah. So
Kaptur's harder to get. I don't know what she will do, whether she's, I don't know if she'll do another term after this, but never say never.
Right.
President Joe Biden has also responded to something that happened here in the short north of Columbus. He responded to a small group of neo-Nazis marching through the streets. Julie, you've been covering this and the reaction.
Yes. So it was a very small group, maybe a dozen people masked with head coverings and Nazi flags dressed in black. They were spewing sort of racial slurs and anti-Semitism. There was a debate about whether there was a physical altercation, but the Columbus police ultimately decided there was not anything that rose to the level to arrest anyone. But you know, both the governor and President Biden have come out to say, you know, hate is not wanted here in this city, in this country, in this state. And, you know, it's interesting because some of what I see online is people saying, well, this is their free speech right. And I think that, yes, while that's true, you know, certainly that's what leaders are for in government is to set standards. And they're trying to say that, like, let's tamp this down while we can.
Yeah, I always say freedom of speech doesn't mean freedom from consequences right. or freedom from condemnation for what you're doing. Joe, finally, I want to touch on something that's maybe a little bit happier or at least more bipartisan. There's agreement that the mental health of mothers in their first year after their children are born is critical and that it affects both the infants and the mothers. So there's a push to address this legislatively.
Yeah, there's a House concurrent resolution that would basically raise awareness of perinatal mental health. And, you know, a lot of people talk about baby blues. This goes a little beyond that. The perinatal health issue is that period starts from the time you get pregnant to the baby's first birthday. And mothers often, you know, you've got a lot going on in your body. You've got a lot going on mentally, dealing with different challenges.
Hormonally.
It's huge. It's a huge change. And there's a mental health issue there in many mothers, and 7 out of 10, Representative Anita Somani, who's a OBGYN herself, she says 7 out of 10 women are not getting treatment during that time. But the thing that's important to remember here is that this is a resolution to raise awareness of the problem. It doesn't have dollars going to a specific program to combat it. And the other thing is that it is not, it hasn't gone through the legislative process. So it's questionable as to whether it will actually get through anytime soon. So we're at the very beginning stages of this.
Yeah. I think it's really important because it's not only when you give birth that right. you can have issues. It's also when your menstrual cycle returns, you can have issues. It's that entire year. And I get the idea of, like, if you say a lot, you're struggling with intrusive thoughts or this, that, and the other, you worry about losing your kids.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much that goes on. Any mother who's had, you know, even if you didn't, you know, give birth and you adopted, it's a huge life change. It affects everything. It affects, you know, you're not going out with your girlfriends as much because you don't have time, right? So that outlet that you had to talk about issues that may be coming up doesn't exist, maybe. And you don't have, you know, and then you throw hormones in it, and, you know, hormones can make you do anything, you know? So it's like, you know, there's a whole lot going on in that year. And the idea is that if women who are struggling have some help during that period of time, that they're better mothers, that makes healthier babies, And, you know, but trying to get people to understand it, especially men who don't go through this or don't go through it in the way that women do, at least, you've got to make them understand that it's a big issue and that something needs to be done about it.
That was Joe Ingles, reporter for the State House News Bureau. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to Julie Carr Smythe, government and politics reporter for the Associated Press.
Thanks for having me.
And Haley B. Miller, political reporter at the Columbus Dispatch.
Good to be here.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.